Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help members of the military community thrive in their post-service career. Today is episode number 368, Feltmans of Coney Island with Joe Quinn.
When my brother and I started this company, so we have a hot dog company called Feltmans of Coney Island, and the first thing people do is laugh. It's one is negative, one is like, you know, there's a bit of laughing at you, like, not taking you serious kind of. The other, there's just something about a hot dog that makes people smile. And that has been so, such a breath of fresh air compared to with a lot of the hard work that I've done since 9/11, whether in combat in the war or post that in the veteran space. It's been quite the journey. And again, to do it with my brother and a team of veterans. So we have a team of veterans. We have five veteran employees that total over 30 years in uniform and 13 months deployed. So
today's episode is a must listen. Here's my top three reasons. One, entrepreneurship. Joe and his brother started Feltmans of Coney Island and is a self-proclaimed hot dog slinger. Seriously, do you need another reason? Okay, fine. Here's reason number two, selflessness. The impetus for starting Feltmans was the loss of Joe's brother on September 11th. The way in which Joe and his brother honor their deceased brother is touching, to say the least. Third, mindset. Joe is the executive director of Headstrong, which provides best-in-class therapy for veterans. It's an incredible organization. We also talk about how often we as veterans can mask our own internal struggle by looking to help others. There's some really good insights there. So those are my top three reasons for listening to this episode, but honestly, wouldn't this have been a lot easier for all of us if we would have just taken my word on this? And of course, this interview was only made possible due to the financial sponsorship of the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management. And I want to share a little bit more about them. Whether you're transitioning to a civilian career or continuing military service, an MBA from Carlson at the University of Minnesota prepares you for a high-impact career in business. Carlson is committed to the veteran community and provides the benefits, experiential learning, and network to accelerate your career. In addition to a resident tuition waiver, all admitted full-time MBA military candidates receive generous scholarships and stipends to cover expenses that may not be eligible for the GI Bill. To learn more, you can visit the show notes at beyonduniform.org for this episode, or you can email mba@umn.edu. Lastly, in the show notes for this episode, I'm going to add in a couple related episodes, one about an individual who started a company called Keto Butta, in case you're interested in food entrepreneurship, an episode about Team Red, White, and Blue. That's an organization we talk about. So if you want to go deeper, there's some related episodes there. With that, let's dive into my conversation with Joe. Joining me today in Breezy Point, Queens, getting out of New York City for months now, my guest today is Joe Quinn. Joe, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Great. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So maybe we'll switch things up from the way I normally do it. Could you give us maybe the 30 to 60 second version of what your career has looked like from the time that you left the Army until now?
Yeah, so interesting, as quickly as possible. So I left active duty actually in 2008. And I'd go on to grad school for 2 years at Harvard Kennedy School. But then I would get back into the fight. I went to Afghanistan as a civilian advisor. And then shortly after that, going back to West Point, where I graduated in 2002, to serve as an instructor and also serve as an associate in the Combating Terrorism Center. From there, I made sort of a light exit out of the military, but into the veteran nonprofit space with a small organization at the time called Team Red, White, and Blue with a bunch of friends before taking the mantle as the executive director of Headstrong. And now I sell hot dogs with my brother. So we get into that later. This is a very long winding path to kind of different industries post-military service.
And we've got several episodes on Team Red, White, and Blue, and I'll post those in the show notes. But I don't think that we've talked about, I don't think we've interviewed Headstrong. So could you just give us an understanding of what you do as an organization?
Yeah, so I was so I started in the veteran nonprofit space with Team Red, White, and Blue. Mike Irwin, who's a really good friend of mine, he founded it when we were both teaching at West Point at the time, and he said, "Hey, why don't you help give this a shot?" It was a really small thing at the time, and then became a very big thing. And then during that time, I kind of struggled with my own sort of transition out of the military. And I feel like a lot of veterans that enter the veteran nonprofit space is a clear indicator that they're not doing well with their transition because you have a hard time sort of letting it go. So it was during my time at Team Red, White, and Blue here in New York City, where I'm originally from, that Headstrong just started getting, started around the same time as a kind of a young veteran organization. And I would constantly refer veterans from Team White and Blue to seek mental health treatment at Headstrong. And it wasn't until about 2015, 2016, maybe, that I referred myself and my family, and I was able to get sort of the help that I needed. And Headstrong is just very, very simple organization in that it provides unlimited bureaucracy-free mental health treatment and therapy. So you go to getheadstrong.org and you fill out a 60-second survey with just your name and kind of where you're at. You're contacted within 24, 48 hours by a social worker who then pairs you with a psych evaluation by an MD, by a doctor, and then pairs you with the best-in-class clinician in your local market for unlimited therapy. And these therapists are, what I mean to say, the best, they're the best. It's people that the kind of the founding statement around Headstrong was one of the co-founders, Al Rabel, was talking to the other co-founder, Zach Iskel, who's a great Marine here in the city and co-founded a bunch of different things. But he basically said, Al Rabel, as someone that's done very wealthy, he's very wealthy and done well, if I needed mental health services, I could get an appointment with the best psychologist, psychiatrist in New York tomorrow. Why can't our veterans have that same experience? So it went from serving, one veteran, one clinician, serving one veteran, one therapy hour in one city in around 2013 to today, Headstrong serving thousands a month in 27 cities across the country with thousands of therapists. So it's just kind of remarkable what they've done for veterans across the country, and even not only just personally what's done for my family and a bunch of friends that have joined the program as well.
I want to come back to one of the things you said, but first I'll say, longtime listeners have probably heard me talk about therapy, men's work, meditation, executive coaching. I'm an enormous advocate for myself and every person on the planet of, if you're training for the Olympics, you surround yourself with a team to help you mentally, emotionally, physically be your best. And I'm so excited to hear about that, Joe. And I'm curious, first of all, besides the 60-second survey, what needs to be true for someone to work with Headstrong? Do they need to be on active duty? Could they be a veteran? Could they be a military family? Like, who falls under this umbrella?
Yeah, so, again, anyone, the wheelhouse is post 9/11 veterans, right? So, and that could be any discharge status, that could be active duty, it could be guard, it could be a veteran. And the reason being is Headstrong has been built to be preventative, right? Get Joe Quinn before he starts making bad lifelong decisions about his relationships, about, self-medicating, about quitting a job. It's so that is essentially the wheelhouse. We do have military spouses that are part of the program. There's a bunch of couples therapy involved with it, and it really comes down to the veteran being the sort of the entry point, and then getting help for the entire family. But the great thing about Headstrong is that it's tailor-made to the veteran and their family. There's all, if you probably very well rehearsed in this, everyone has the cure, right? It's like, oh, you just have to run. Oh, you just have to do yoga. You just have to do this type of therapy. Headstrong doesn't take that approach. They do a great evaluation system to work with the veteran on addressing the needs that they need to take care of. using all different types of evidence-based treatments, which are dozens that have proven very fruitful. But it's about the veteran and solving their problem and not pushing something or one particular thing on you.
Is there anything you'd want to share about your own experience? Because it sounds like not only were you referring people there, but you also worked with them as a on the receiving side. What would you want listeners to know about that? And I'm asking because both with my military friends and non-military friends, my sense is that there is often a negative stigma about therapy, and the stigma that I'm most familiar with is like you need to be broken to do it, which is not my experience and not how I perceive it. But anything you want to share related to that?
Yeah, 100%. So, I mean, to talk about stigma for a second, if anyone had stigma going against them, I'm a Brooklyn kid in an Irish Catholic family. I went to all boys schools, combat veteran, like, so every single thing that involves stigma, I had all those cards going against me with that line, right? Just move on, throw dirt on it, just keep moving. You're weak if you ask for help, all those sorts of things. So I went through that in spades. So I understand it, but it's a poor excuse for people not to receive help. And I admit that I dealt with that for a long, long time. So that's sort of the first thing. And then to just give a little bit about my family story and getting to that point was, so when I was a senior at West Point about to enter active duty Army, my brother Jimmy was killed in the World Trade Center. He worked for a company called Cantor Fitzgerald. He was 23 years old, right out of college. He was on the 102nd floor of the North Tower and perished that day with 657 of his coworkers there at Cantor Fitzgerald. So, you know, my life completely changed, and I think the lives of many veterans that are probably listening because of that day. You know, I went from, you know, I want to get a good education, I wanted to play basketball at West Point, and just being sort of, I guess, any kind of arrogant, bratty 21-year-old that's in college, you know, being a senior in college, to my world just being completely shaken. So, you know, I'd go on to do two tours in Iraq, and I went to Afghanistan as a civilian advisor. And I just sort of bottled up, you know, all of those sorts of feelings. And in between tours, I was a general's aide, and I started eventually dating the general's daughter. That's a whole other story. But so Melanie has an interesting story of her own. So Melanie, who's my wife now, she had two brothers that died. Her brother Kevin died by suicide in June 2003, and then her oldest brother Jeff died by an IED in Iraq in February 2004. So the reason I mention that is we got married. We're back in New York. Joe's back home. He's not in war. White picket fence. She's the nurse. I'm out saving veterans. And externally, there's all of these sorts of things that you would think, oh, that, you know, that person's fine. So while externally everything looked great, internally, things couldn't be worse. And it was sort of a conversation with Melanie one night that said we weren't going to make it together unless we did something about it, which found us in the Headstrong office very shortly after. So the reason I tell that kind of long winding story is one, stigma is real, but it's not an excuse. Getting help, it's the same thing you would get help in training for a marathon or weightlifting or whatever it is. Like, help is available, go get it. And your story is unique and different. The reason I tell my story is that I feel like sometimes as veterans, I have to have a physical wound, or I'm not as bad as that other guy, or what have you. And it's that view of it. Sometimes we envision like Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump, and like, that guy needs help, not me. And I mean, you're talking about a couple with advanced degrees, and seemingly externally everything was fine. So break through the stigma, get the help you need, and be selfish about it, right? If there's something that's part of you, get the help you need, because it's not only just about surviving, it's about going to therapy or finding that thing to make you a better version of yourself that you ever thought possible. And that's sort of where my wife and I find ourselves now.
Beautiful. I love that. I appreciate your candor on that. I would also throw out, for therapy in general or couples counseling, I'm a big advocate of preventative maintenance from my days on submarines. And, my wife and I, when we were 6 months into dating, at the height of kind of the love affair, when everything is perfect, we started going to couples workshops because our sense was like, let's do the work now while it's easy. Let's not come into this with a decade. It was kind of interesting because so many people in these workshops have been married for 2 decades, and you just have 2 decades of resentment built up. We're like, God, let's nip this in the bud before it gets to that point. So I love your analogy on the marathon and the weight room, and all of those things are true. But yeah, I love that. And I'll add a link in the show notes for listeners for getheadstrong.org. One thing I wanted to key in as well is you said that you gravitated towards Team Red, White, and Blue and towards Get Headstrong. And you said that veterans, I get this picture, it's like kind of this gravitational pull that sucks them in. Why do you think that so many veterans, for good or bad, get pulled into the nonprofit world?
There's good and bad reasons. And again, everyone's story is different. One, I think is fear. And I could say that for myself, in that it's more comfortable, right? Like, it's the one foot out. And that's what the veteran nonprofit space did for me, is like, okay, I got out of the military, but I'm not going to go jump all the way headfirst into a completely different industry, in the sense that I'm still around familial settings, some of these things that are familiar, being around different veterans. Second, as I mentioned earlier, and there's a ton of people that have come out and that are known in the veteran space that said they're going to therapy, so on and so forth. Some that haven't, that we won't talk about. But it's amazing to me how many people that are active in the veteran space, particularly to the post 9/11 generation, that are struggling so deeply with so many different issues. So it was almost a signal of, and again, it's that veteran mentality that, I don't deserve it, so I'm going to go do this to help myself or help others. And that's sort of easier to deal with. For me, it was that I don't want to deal with my own thing. So I'm going to join a veteran nonprofit to help others. Meanwhile, you're masking, your own internal struggle by doing that. And I think that's a lot more widespread. And again, I imagine a ton of your listeners are active in the veteran nonprofits. And then not only just a full-time job, but whether you're a volunteer with Team Red, White, and Blue or Team Rubicon, I think that active step to do something within the space is indicating, whether the people know it or not, that, hey, I might need to check myself and make sure that I'm okay before I could, help others. I always do the analogy of when you're on planes and they always tell you, put the mask on your child first, put the mask on yourself first before putting it on your child. And I think it's very similar as veterans are getting out of the service, is you got to make sure that you're okay first before you could be effective in being there for your family or your friends or former service members that you serve with.
That's wonderful. I mean, I've had so many guests on the show who either currently or in the past have worked at a nonprofit. And I always interpret it as scratching the itch around purpose and trying to find identity and stuff. But the piece that you hit on, I think, is very true. And I'll just say too, I'm 12 years out of the military and I'm still learning. Like, God, I've got to prioritize my own self-care. I have to focus on my own nourishment, which I've got a whole litany of things that I do to be grounded in my best self. And it still feels selfish. It still feels like I should be doing this for my wife or my community or for my son. And I attribute a lot of that to the military. I think part of it might just be being a human being as well, or a man. But I will say that of the 360 veterans I've interviewed for the show, I think it's fairly common to say that it's easier for us to think of the team rather than for ourselves. So I love that you're pointing that out and highlighting that.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's just something that's really rampant out in the space. We used to call it, when I was here in Blue, I used to call it one downing. It's the opposite of one upping. It's sort of like, I feel like veterans, particularly when they come out, they're always sort of one downing what they're going through or their needs, because they'd rather focus on helping someone else. So 100%.
And we may kind of come back, because there's so many rich pockets in your history to delve into, but I want to delve a lot more into your current work. If you were to bump into someone from the Air Force on the streets and they're like, "Joe, what do you do for a living?" How do you answer that?
I tell them I sling hot dogs for a living now, you know? So, and it was part of the inspiration. And even for me, from like a business perspective of starting this 5 years ago with my brother, there's many facets to it, but even to now, like really going headfirst into it, is finally making that full separation from the military. And to be perfectly frank, I found myself going down the road of being what, you know, a lot of people call the professional veteran, right? Like, how long am I going to go around telling my story and that sort of my value to our society, and dealing with, you know, veterans and mental health and suicide and being inundated as my, you know, young family is sort of growing. So it's been sort of fun to that aspect of it. So yeah, when my brother and I started this company, so we have a hot dog company called Feltman's of Coney Island, and the first thing people do is laugh. It's one is negative. One is like, you know, there's a bit of laughing at you, like not taking you serious kind of. The other, there's just something about a hot dog that makes people smile. And that has been so, such a breath of fresh air compared to with a lot of the hard work that I've done since 9/11, whether in combat in the war or post that in the veteran space. And I found it's interesting too. There's almost been this, a silent majority of people that have texted me and like, man, I like, you know, that are very highly regarded in certain, you know, industries, particularly nonprofits. It's like, I always wanted to do something like that. I've always wanted to kind of unplug and just do something that's like completely outside of veterans, so on and so forth. So it's been quite the journey. And again, to do it with my brother and a team of veterans. So we have a team of veterans. We have five veteran employees that total over 30 years in uniform and 113 months deployed. So it's good to be at that point now where I used to talk about veterans being an asset in hiring. And now just to not only just talk the talk, but to walk the walk and just, you know, find veterans and hire them, because they're the best of the best when it comes to executing, particularly in a nebulous startup environment where you just need to wear multiple hats and get things done.
So if we were to go in a time machine 30 years ago, would we see a little Joe and his brother, you know, with, instead of a lemonade stand, a hot dog stand, or like where did this come from? Was this a lifelong thing, or can you pinpoint the moment that where you're like, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah. So I grew up with two brothers. My brother, Michael, is the oldest. Jimmy, who passed away on 9/11, was the middle child, that typical middle child, didn't shut up. And then I was the more quieter, you know, more to sports, that would probably be destined for a job as a cop or a firefighter or in the military. So we couldn't have been more different. And Jimmy was the one that stoked the flame. He was the businessman man of the brothers, and just always dreamed of starting a company as brothers. You know, just sometimes you see those businesses, they're like, three brothers and brothers and co. And he had this vision of, you know, going to Wall Street, cutting his teeth, making a bit of money and then financing a business that we'd all run. To go back, we're from Southern Brooklyn. So we grew up around Coney Island. And my brother, Michael, is the oldest. He remembers everything. He's the one that he gets fixated on things. And since he was a child, when my grandfather and aunts and uncles used to tell him about old Coney Island, and there was this magical place called Feltman's that was the biggest restaurant in the world, and they had the best hot dogs. And, you know, nowadays hot dogs are terrible. This is how it used to be done, so on and so forth. My brother remembers everything. He remembers coming out of the womb, my brother Michael. But he just gets so infatuated with things. So to me, I was sort of the you know, the teammate that would be there for the business, and Jimmy would lead the charge. And it was Mike's infatuation with Coney Island and Feltman's that from a very young age that we were kind of discussing. So fast forward to 2015, obviously Jimmy is no longer with us. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, I can't imagine losing a child. You know, obviously I think it's natural that we lose parents, and I can't imagine losing my spouse, but losing siblings is not something I feel like that's talked about a lot in our society. And I guess because my wife and I both have lost siblings, that it's a common thing in that, particularly when you lose them young, you're hoping for a life with that individual for, you know, 70 years. And Jimmy left an enormous hole in our family. And he was the glue between Michael and I. And it was just sort of very difficult to manage without him. And so it was 2015 where we were walking at McSorley's Ale House, which is a famous oldest bar in New York City. And Mike was just going on. We were watching a Mets game. The Mets were down like 9 runs. And he was going on and on about, you know, this Feltman's thing again. And I said, maybe I must have been a couple darks too deep. But I said, screw it, Mike. Let's just do it. Let's do it. Jimmy's not here. We have a lot of gaps to fill. I mean, I don't know. So we just started talking about it and getting energized. And what I noticed immediately was that it built a bond between my brother and I, who have so many different interests. It was almost the idea was Jimmy – was like Jimmy being part of it. Like it was, the idea became the gap that Jimmy filled. It was that we were able to passionately talk about it, come up with different ideas. And the bartender at McSorley's that we've really known for, you know, 3 decades. So we start telling him about it, and he looks us in the eye and he says, one, this has to be the dumbest idea I ever heard. And two, you know how many drunk Irish guys come in here telling us their grand ideas for life and never do it? And that angered me enough to stay up all night and build a website. I applied for a trademark, an LLC, and Mike woke up the next day with all these documents in his inbox. It was like, oh, I guess we're doing it. And we just kind of started from there. And it's been just an incredibly wild journey ever since.
I think it's such a wonderful tribute to Jimmy of speaking to his legacy of the role he played in your family. It's just beautiful to think of you and your brother crafting this together. And it's like the sense I get is that he is this, you know, they talk about an investor as having a silent partner, and he's like the silent presence that's there. I think that's really wonderful. Let's maybe go back a year ago, because I know we're in the midst of, things are very irregular right now. What's kind of like been your day-to-day life? Like, are you pushing a cart down the street and saying, get your hot dogs here? Are you in the office all the time? Like, what does it look like to run Feltman's of Coney Island?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, there's all sorts of great stories that are baked into the founding of a company, from, you know, selling your first hot dog. We used to have a kitchen window on St. Mark's Place when my brother was parked, you know, for 50 hours a week, and we just sell hot dogs out of the window. And it wasn't until other veterans that are part of this ownership group that got involved, that about 2 years ago, we made the decision, you know, Mike and I originally had this idea of being like the Shake Shack of hot dogs, and maybe we'll franchise. And it was 2 years ago where we dropped that idea because restaurants are super difficult. Yeah. Ever met a friend that runs a restaurant? And I think we're seeing it now with so many friends that are going through a hard time. But we went to pivot towards supermarkets because that's what people wanted. We had that kitchen window. People would come to the window. They didn't want a hot dog and a bun with sauerkraut. They're like, hey, can I just get a 6-pack of those hot dogs to go? And they'd buy them for like $20, and we couldn't believe it. And so that was early signals that people wanted the hot dog, and that was the center of what our kind of our brand was. So we pivoted towards supermarkets and e-commerce. And thank God we did, because we would have been sunk because of the pandemic. So sort of the day-to-day is, we have about, when you add sort of the sales team and sort of the marketing PR team, we have about a 12-person team that's all working from home, all working from, New York and Pennsylvania and Jersey and Vegas, and all across the country, that is, co-packing, making the hot dogs, doing the sales to get into supermarkets. We just launched in over 1,200 Publix in the Southeast, doing e-commerce, which has been a tremendous uptick in part of our business over the last 4 to 6 months. So that's it. It's just the good thing for me and what I've become, sort of, I love now. It's almost like I just feel I really feel found my niche. And again, I get to work with these great veterans that I know, and we get to do this together. And starting a company, it's hard. It's like there's no romanticizing entrepreneurship. It's awful. Every day you're living and dying. It really is. But I get to do it with a great group of people that I love, that are, I lost a brother, but I'm always looking for brothers. And these folks are like my brothers and sister. One is actually my blood brother, which is sort of a great bonus. But it's just sort of what I love, the niche is I love doing it. I love the work of it. It's almost like it doesn't even matter what the product is. My brother is obsessed with hot dogs and Coney Island, so I love that he gets a lot of juice out of that. It gives him a lot of passion for life. But I just love this stage of a company. And I feel like I was in this exact stage with Headstrong. I was in this exact stage with sort of Team Red, White, and Blue. And even in the military, when you're just dumped in Iraq as a platoon leader in the middle of nowhere, and you're just got to scrap to make things work. That's sort of the part that I love. And that's kind of where we are, and just sort of the fight every day to keep this thing going.
I think it's great to hear the receptivity you had to customer feedback to pivot. I'm thinking of distinct moments when I had similar feedback as an entrepreneur and I didn't listen and missed out on the opportunity. And so it's great to see that you heard that feedback and analyzed it. It made sense to you and you followed that. That's awesome. How does one even start with this? Like, I mean, did you when you, I love that you took the leverage of like, this guy told me I'm not going to be able to do this company, so I'll show him, and you do all the incorporation stuff. But were you, if we were to do a musical montage and a video, are you and your brother like creating hot dogs and grinding it up and doing taste tests, or how does that even start?
Yeah, so we started. So one, here's the benefit. If there's any veteran entrepreneurs out there, it's so cheap. We're so blessed in this time where it's so easy to start a business, right? Like, and again, I used it all, like legal work, LegalZoom, email account, Gmails, or Shopify, or I built the first website on Wix.com, and like use it. Like, and again, it's so cost effective that like any idea you have, rather than talk about it, just do it. You could do it for, several hundred dollars, whatever it might be. Like, that part's easy, and that's where you can kind of get that feedback immediately. And that's kind of the purity that I love about the for-profit versus the nonprofit. It's like either you like it or you don't, right? And nonprofit is a lot of dancing. It's not always about what the program is. It's always, sometimes it's the cult, the personality of who, founded the nonprofit or who's part of it. Where, for-profit, it's like, there's such a purity, and I think that's the strength of America, is that you either like it or you don't, and there's competitors, and you have to compete against them, so you have to really listen to them. But early on, when it came down to it, there was a lot of moments, and it really came down to making the hot dog. So my brother had all this information from my grandfather and all through notes he took his whole life that he needed to get out of his brain and written down. So there's a lot of food industries and CPG, and particularly for the hot dog, they're all made by the same three companies, and they just slap labels on it. And it's just terrible meat. It's like collagen casing, and they just pound it with garlic. And, because there's a lot of big companies that were infatuated with this idea of our brand and this original hot dog and the story we're telling, They're like, oh, we'll just slap your logo on it. And you know, I hope my wife doesn't listen to this, because I put about $20,000 on my credit card to make $20,000 worth of hot dogs, to make about 300 pounds worth of hot dogs, with not knowing if it would sort of succeed or not. And once we had that blend, that right spice mix that we had from the heritage of Feltman, the right snap, the right lamb casing, the right size, all of those sorts of things, that's the big gamble when you get into, when you start putting your credit card down for, you know, hundreds of pounds of hot dogs. But, you know, we had to do it, or else, you know, you don't have a business, right? You don't have a differentiation for what you're doing. So that was the early days, was, you know, we were in my brother's 300 square foot apartment, doing some mixing and sausage making and taste testing. And then he, you know, getting sausage makers to help make it at a little bit more scale in the hundreds of pounds. And then Mike would do these pop-up restaurants and bars throughout New York City. And then on the Wix website online, he would get an order, and he'd be in his 300 square foot apartment. He'd get printed off. He'd go to his refrigerator in his tiny kitchen. He'd pack the box. He'd go to UPS downstairs and ship it out. So that was sort of the visual of the early business. And the fun thing about it is, it really hasn't changed much since. It's really a lot of the same business, but just magnified.
It is. I think that's incredible. And I'll put in the show notes for listeners. There's an episode I did with Aaron Barnes, who runs a company called Keto Butter. That's, you know, he had a similar process, like in his kitchen, grinding up the stuff and packaging it. It seems like so fun, but it's also so daunting to think about that. And I'm curious what advice you have for someone who right now is listening to this episode and nodding their head, and they're like, I want to start my own company in the, let's just call it the food industry. What advice do you have for them, being a veteran and going to do that?
Yeah. You know, one I would say is, you know, there's two ways in business, right? There's you could be price competitive, or you could be different, right? And you almost have to be different, right? So in making our hot dog, it was like, it has to be premium, and you see the difference. Like, it has to be premium. It's the biggest hot dog you've ever seen. It's 6 to a pound. It's natural lamb casing. It has that great snap. It has premium cuts of beef. It has an original, you know, old world spice blend. So it's completely different experience. So start there and say, like, what's the differentiations? And think in threes. What are three different differentiators that are going to have with this product? And then just give it for a run in your kitchen. It doesn't have to be perfect. Again, we weren't born sausage makers. We just wanted sort of some sense of what it could taste and be different from. And then starts the process of co-packing, right? And that is sort of the chicken and egg sort of situation, because we found ourselves in the middle of a lot of co-packers had minimums, right? We will only do, you know, 3,000 pounds, which is, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or $100,000 worth of hot dog meat. But just never stopping being persevering and just trying to find that co-packer that can make your product. Because once we had a product and we had a label on it and we sold it once, then it's just a matter of doing it again and repeating that as many times as possible. So, you know, I just got goosebumps this week because I remembered going through that process, and we sold in what, well, we were in one butcher shop in Brooklyn, in the neighborhood we grew up in. And the only reason he accepted us was a favor from our mother. So our mother got us into this first butcher shop in Brenneman's. And to think that we're now in, 1,200 public stores and over 3,000 supermarkets across the country. But like, don't be paralyzed by that initial step. And then, you know, the other thing psychologically I did was, what are things that you spend money on that might be frivolous, whether it's like fantasy sports, or maybe you go out three nights a week or whatever, or, you know, season tickets to whatever. And if you could kind of mentally tell yourself, like, oh, I spend $10,000 a year on these things. Why wouldn't you spend $10,000 for the year, you know, over a 12-month period on something that could profit, you know, possibly be profit generating? Because like putting the credit card down, I think, is the hardest thing to do. But, you know, once you're able to make that product, then it's never easy, but then that's the most difficult part. Then it's just rinse and repeat.
As you look, and I'm asking this question because both for military and non-military, there's always this question of when is the time right? Like, when do you need to build skills and when do you need to carpe diem? And so as you look back on a pretty rich career since the military, you had grad school at Harvard, you had Team Red, White, Blue, you built up some chops there. Do you think you could have started this straight out of the Army, or in what ways did your experiences since then help or hurt you in getting this off the ground?
Yeah, so I would say I would answer that question threefold. And one is education, two is experience, and three is network. And they come during various different stages of your post-military career. The easiest is education. When I mean education, it doesn't mean you have to go to some fancy grad school, whatever. Like, so right now I'm about 6 credits away from my MBA at Baruch College. And I love it because it's, I'm actively using the knowledge, right? And again, it, to me, it was like, okay, rather than watching, I'm a diehard Mets fan, you know, Mets games, you know, Monday to Wednesday night, I'm going to go to class. I'm going to take marketing classes. So education, particularly, you have to remember how blessed we are as veterans to have those assets, whether it's voc rehab, whether it's GI Bill, even the VA loan. It's almost ridiculous, the assets that we have as veterans, and you should 100% utilize it. And so that's the easy part. Like, never stop learning. Never say, like, because I was told my resume went out, and when I got out of the military, and one of the respondents was, I read your resume and it seems the only thing you're good at is war. And I was like, I guess you're right. But I do the Office Microsoft suites, if that helps. But, you know, so get that education, use every benefit. You know, two is sort of experience, that fail fast, just fail. Don't, I think veterans, we're more scared of failure because we were looked at as, you know, the uniform with the medals and you're these heroes, and like, God forbid, we're seen as failing at something, right? Like, oh man, if I fail at hot dog business, people are going to laugh at me. Like, what are you thinking? Like, you're selling hot dogs. That's dumb. And now it's going to fail. Like, all those things creep in your head. But every successful person I've seen that is older than me, they started early, they failed. And it's always that second bite of the apple, the third, the fourth, because while education is important and we have those benefits, you're never going to learn quicker than just doing it. Just do it. Build the website, put it up, try to figure out the structure. I was listening to this podcast on how I built this on Coco Vita, the coconut water. And, you know, he's this guy in New York. He was saying how he had like, you know, $100,000 worth of cocoa water being imported to New York. And they're like, he didn't realize that you needed like paperwork to get that done, right? And he had to send it to the Bahamas. It was this whole thing. And, you know, Coco Vita now owns 60% market share of, but like that attitude, it's just do it. Just scrape your knuckles and do it. Don't be afraid of failure. And then lastly, which is the network, like authentically network. And I think my past experience of like starting in the veteran nonprofit and sort of building that network. And I think veterans are sometimes scared to build a network. We see it as almost dirty. But I think it's an authentic network. There's still people I talk to in the veteran nonprofit space that I text every day, and like I would do things for them even if it didn't involve a grant or what have you. And so I think those three things, if you're just doing something every day to educate yourself, to try something new, to fail at, and then, you know, someone to connect with, like the way we're connecting to build your network, that's sort of the path forward.
What is something that listeners probably don't know about entrepreneurship?
Something that listeners don't know about entrepreneurship is that, and I don't know if they know it, that it's harder than, I'm trying to say this the right way. It's not your path, right? Like, there is nothing wrong to having an awesome job and working with people you love to work with and getting great benefits and, you know, so on and so forth. And I must say this, like, the only reason I was able to start with Team Red, White, and Blue when we had like $60,000 in the bank and, you know, jump to Headstrong and to do, you know, some entrepreneurial things here with Veltmans is because I have a wife who's a nurse practitioner who has medical insurance. You know what I mean? So the reason of saying of like, I've had a great teammate through all of this, and she deserves most of the credit in anything that I've been able to do or do differently than. But I would say, like, I just sometimes there's a romance around entrepreneurship of like, I want to be my own boss. You'll never be your own boss. I'm convinced there's no such thing as being your own boss. Because if you're building something, you're accountable to somebody always. So some of the romantic stuff out of entrepreneurship, you really need to sort of get out. So if you have a severe passion for something, there's also something that you could do on the side and see how it grows. I'm a big believer in partners too, the fact that I was able to partner with my brother. It's hard to go at it alone. So I know it wasn't one answer, but I see a lot of, you know, I don't know if they're like fake entrepreneurs on like Instagram where it's like, they just want the lifestyle and the image versus just the real awful grind it is to just get something off the ground.
I love that. Could you share a low point in your, God, 5+ year journey with Veltmans and what you took away from that?
Sure. Yeah. There was many low points. So there was a point maybe a year, you know, 2 years in where Mike did a pop-up at, he always knows the name of the bar. It's this real dive bar in like the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And he was there for about 7 hours and I came after work to meet him. And he sold 4 hot dogs that night. And they had a, you know, they were doing trivia and it was just sort of the trivia guy was sort of just making fun of us and making fun of my brother, Mike, of like, and so we went out, we grabbed the bite afterwards and, you know, and I was looking at my credit cards, I was several thousand dollars in the negative. And it was just sort of like, why are we continuing to do this, right? Like, financially doesn't make sense. We can never catch up. It's just, it's not working. And for me, and that's where you need that sort of inspiration to go on. And it was our, you know, is the reason we didn't quit. And I think it's our competitive advantage now, was because of Jimmy. And we said, we made a pact to do this and we're going to do it. And I don't care why or how. We've grown closer. We've had highs. We had fun doing it. And again, looking at the negative dollars on my credit card, it was like, you know, that could have gone to, you know, Mets season tickets in 2017 where they stunk anyway. You know what I mean? So it was through that low point and through that pact we made about, you know, honoring our brother and what he wanted for us. And I don't care if you're Oscar Mayer or Nathan's or who have all sorts of resources. Our competitive advantage is our brother, Jimmy. And if people laugh at us or try to whatever they want to do, we are not going to stop making hot dogs. And that to me was what we needed then and something a motto we live by now.
So powerful. If listeners want to support you, how can they learn more about Veltmans of Coney Island? How can they support you or even try your product?
Yeah, so we ship across the country, so they could go to feltmansofconeyisland.com. That's Feltmans with a T. We could, buy a package of hot dogs, give us a shot. We're also in Publix. We're also in on our website, we have where we're located, so you could buy them in different stores across the country. Follow us. You can easily find us on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. We're highly active on those platforms. I love interacting with customers. It still blows my mind that people actually buy the product and like enjoy it. And I write a thank you note to anyone who a thank you email to anyone that orders online. So, buy something online at feltmansofconeyisland.com. I'll send you a thank you note and give us your feedback. If you're good, bad, or ugly, we'll just try to get better. And it's just, it's incredible. It's just been an incredible journey. And the best part of it, one of the best part of it, is interacting with customers. We call it the Feltman's Army. So, there's some Marines that love our product that don't like calling it the Feltman's Army, but we're an Army family and with a bunch of Army employees. So we're sticking with it.
I love I think your story, Joe, is such an incredible example for those of you who have read the book. I think it's Carol Dweck's God, it's about growth mindset, but she talks about the difference between a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. And what you just said there of like, if we make a mistake, let us know, we'll get better. I really feel like that's a differentiator for anyone to just have that mindset of like, okay, if I make a mistake, fine. We'll figure it out and grow. And I know that for myself, from the military, especially submarines, there's so much aversion to mistakes. Mistakes can be catastrophic rather than a growth opportunity for right reasons. There's loss of life or equipment. But I think that's great. And I've enjoyed so much of our conversation. I've tried to stay out of your way to give you as much bandwidth as possible. I do want to ask one open-ended question at the end, which is, what else? What have we not talked about that you want to share with listeners before we wrap up?
Yeah, sure. No, I appreciate that. And again, you're in a startup. If you're not making mistakes, you're not doing it right. So it's how quickly can you recover and learn from those and get better every single day. I'll leave you with this. It's just, I know it's I had a really difficult time getting out of the military, and I really struggled. And it's easier to sit here like sort of after the fact. My wife and I, again, if we go back to 2014, 15, we didn't think we were going to make it through. We just didn't see a future. And to fast forward 5 years, and we have 3 children now. Our daughter Beckett, who's going to be 4 in September, our middle son, Graham James, who's named after his 3 uncles who passed away. And we just had a new baby girl, who's about 7 weeks old, Cassidy. And the fact that we're able to take a she just passed her board. She's going to be a nurse practitioner. She's on maternity leave. She's going to be a new nurse practitioner come November. And we have these 3 beautiful, healthy kids. And the fact that I live in a country where I even have an attempt to do this, just even a shot at making this work, it is just, I just pinch myself every day. But I also was, the lonely guy at the end of the bar, just wondering how this was all going to shake out, dealing with my own internal struggles. So, there is hope out there, and I, and just keep grinding, get the help you need. And I truly believe that some of the traumatic experiences we go through, there's an avenue to make you better. I don't think we're, I'm not, I don't think I'm doing half these things, if it wasn't for my brother being killed in 9/11. And I would trade it all in for one day with him. But there's a lesson to be learned about growth and just continue to battle and become, a better version of yourself that you ever thought imaginable. So just keep at it.
Awesome. Well, for listeners, I will add in the show notes links to Headstrong, to Feltmans of Coney Island, and a lot of more information about Joe. But thank you for all the work that you do to support the military community. Thank you for being a veteran employer, and thank you for sharing your story with Beyond the Uniform.
Too easy. No, I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
Surface, surface, surface.
Beyond the Uniform is written and produced by me, Justin Nasiri, with help from our Chief of Staff, Steve Bain, our editor, Kathleen Dillon, and our Head of Social Media, Janelle Hanf. We are an all-volunteer organization and would greatly appreciate your help in any of the following three ways. First of all, spread the word. Beyond the Uniform has over 360 podcast episodes and 15 on-demand webinars, all offered for free. Help us spread the word on social media, at military bases, or whatever gets the resource in front of the men and women who need it. Positive reviews on iTunes go a long way towards this as well. Second of all, sponsorship. Beyond the Uniform relies on financial sponsorship to keep us going. There is so much more we'd like to do as well, but just don't have nearly the resources to do so. If you know of a company that would advertise in any way with Beyond the Uniform, please send them our way. Third of all, donations. If you're in a financial position to donate, you can find more information on the support section of our website. At our website, beyondtheuniform.org, you'll find over 360 episodes categorized by industry, functional role, and more. You'll also find both free and for-purchase resources that take a deeper dive on topics related to career growth. Thank you for your support as we aim to help members of the military community thrive in their post-military career and life.